Geekscape.com. Can the White Race Survive? Part 6. The Far East Continued. We have glanced briefly at the evidence that indicates an early black preponderance in the South, leaving its indelible imprint upon the present generation, and we have traced the migration of the whites around to the northern borderlands, whence they debauched upon the ancient kingdom. Now what do we find today to corroborate this second phase of racial additions? Although there are islands of more or less dark skins and platyrhines and mesorhines extending far into the north, on into Korea, Japan and northern Siberia, still the general average is fairer in the middle north with less platyrhiny. This is distinctly the case among the Manchus. The Manchus, the name is of relatively recent origin, are of the old Tungusic stock, which is believed to have furnished the ancestry of the Yamatos, who, by way of Korea, entered the Japanese islands and built the civilization of Nippon. There is reason to believe that the Manchus retained their white purity, or near purity, well into the last millennium. With the constant warfare between the Chinese and their northern neighbours, it was natural that the northern invaders, even when at times driven back, should have taken captives who were later assimilated. The custom among the Tatars of taking captive women into their harems would account for much infiltration of mongrel blood from the slowly mongrelizing Chinese during the almost endless struggles. By this slow process, the old white warrior peoples of Siberia and ancient Mongolia ever so gradually drew into their racial strain the skin-coloring blood of the Negro, which came by way of the already yellowing Chinese, if not in some cases by the capture, during earlier times, of actual Negro slaves themselves. The Manchus were evidently, during earlier times, as their main body of descendants are today, a land-tilling, peaceable folk. This, to some extent, protected their racial strain for a longer time than the case with some of their neighbours. However, in the 17th century, having developed into a sufficiently warrior people to be the last northern invaders and conquerors of the vast Chinese Empire, the borders of their region were opened wide to immigration from the south, and Chinese came in large numbers. In spite of this heavy infiltration of the yellow men during the last 3 centuries, with whom they have freely intermarried, we find sections where there is a type still white of skin and with brown and even hazel eyes. Dudley Buxton supports our contention of a white origin for the Manchus and inferentially of other North Asiatic peoples. He says, in treating of the Manchus, "Some of the observations appear to suggest a close relationship with the northern Chinese, others a very different strain. I think that the skin colour and the eye colour, if closely examined, show similar divergences. Some of the Manchus are very definitely yellow, others, though, no doubt they might be classed as yellow or brown by a superficial observer, inclined to brown on the exposed parts of the body, and to white on the unexposed parts. The solution which I am inclined to suggest is that we have here again an old mixture of Alpine with yellow man, not dissimilar to what has occurred in Mongolia. A very large number of Manchus show facial features which belong to the West rather than the East, adding additional weight to this hypothesis. In a small collection of crania, or in a series of measurements made in one area, as, for instance, tori's were, There is every possibility that such a racial mixture, cutting across national and linguistic boundaries as it does, would be obscured or entirely concealed. Since the 17th century, the Manchus, with their military organization of the Bannermen, have been widely scattered over China. For the most part, they have become entirely absorbed in the population. Certain exceptions have, however, occurred. It was one of the terms which China forced upon her conquerors that no Chinese woman should ever enter the imperial harem, and in many families, alliance with the Manchus would have been considered a disgrace. There remain, therefore, some Manchus who today have probably retained, even in China, their old racial type, but for the most part, it is necessary to search in some of the more remoter parts of Manchuria for the old Manchu type. It is a fact that I very early observed, here corroborated by Buxton, that even in the heart of China, the Manchu has retained much of his white blood and is often found with a surprisingly European physiognomy and complexion. This question is pertinent here. Let the solar pigmentationists answer. Why is the Manchu so nearly of the white type, while his Chinese neighbours, whose ancestors can scarcely claim to have been in Asia much longer, are yellow and brown? Why are there much darker races to the northeast, and even within the Arctic Circle, these latter equally ancient or more ancient occupants of their regions? Perhaps the climatic theorists might answer this question by saying that a mixture with torrid zone blacks has occurred in the past to give colour to the dark tribes of far northeastern Asia and to the inhabitants intervening. If so, then the assertions set forth hereafter are essentially correct, that white peoples came into Asia from the West many thousands of years ago, the earliest immigrants entering directly from the West through the Turkestan region, later ones in different invading waves from the Northwest and the North. That these whites, retaining a goodly balance of racial purity through 2,000 years or more, built up the ancient Chinese civilization, that they found indigenous Negroes and very likely imported more from the southern peninsulas and islands where we still find Negro peoples, that miscegenation with the Negro increased to such a point that by or before the time of Confucius, the old glory of China had deteriorated. Deterioration had proceeded so far that Confucius' inauguration of ancestor worship fell upon willing ears, because the ability to progress to greater heights had been lost. To dream of past glory was a treasured heritage. Just as in the rise and decline of other ancient civilizations, we can definitely prove that the development of China's progress reached an acme, then fell, not to complete decay, for the quantity of white man's blood was still considerable, no doubt always higher among the upper classes, as it surely still is, but it did fall away very distinctly. Most assuredly, there cannot be found a serious student of Chinese history who would claim there has been any vestige of progress from within China during the Christian era. Since the Western world made its contact with China, that land has almost come to be synonymous with stagnation. The tendency among the Chinese to eschew all progress and hold fast to as much of the old as possible is a veritable religion of the people. Only within the last generation has the younger element, stimulated by Occidental education, begun trying vainly to fan the ancient spirit to life. As well try to stand the felled oak again upon its severed stump and make it take on new life. The intellectual capacity has departed forever, the cranial cavity capacity of the Chinese, on an average, stands about halfway between the white and the Negro. It would be very enlightening if we could secure measurements of the crania of 3,000 years ago. But Chinese ancestor veneration has thus far prevented this. The history of China is not clear. No doubt there is a wealth of more precise history of the ancient empire hidden away in the archaic scripts of 2,000 and more years ago, but the Chinese historian, sufficiently scholarly and painstaking to unearth it, has not appeared. Perhaps it will fall to the lot of Western historians to perform the Herculean task. When this is done, we shall be better able to perceive the chronological order of the rise and fall of Oriental civilization. We are already able to definitely state that sometime between 500 BC and 1,000 years later, there was a falling away from the arts and sciences that had gone forward to a noteworthy degree, just as some of the science of ancient Egypt is lost to the world, so have the Chinese lost priceless formulas, notably in the art of porcelain making. In nautical science, the ancients of China were great masters, but the Chinese junks of later times would not offer proof of such. S. Wells Williams says of this phase of Chinese retrogression, "Charts for the guidance of the navigator, or instruments to aid him in determining his position at sea, the Chinese are nearly, or quite destitute, of. They have retrograded, rather than advanced, in navigation, judging from the accounts of Fahian, Ibn Battuta, and other travellers, when their vessels frequented the Persian Gulf and the Malabar coast, and carried on a large trade with the archipelago. Such knowledge as they have on these points is hidden away in their libraries, as the Latin and Greek classics were in European convents and castles 1,000 years ago. I believe that if a really clear history of China is ever rescued from the ancient parchments or bamboo staves, we shall thrill with the story of Chinese vessels spanning the wide Pacific 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, planting colonies not only in Polynesia, but in the Americas and in the isolated Hawaiian Islands. How else can we reasonably explain the presence of humanity in the Hermit Islands of mid-Pacific? Surely no unskilled savages in their crude dugouts ever could have reached them. There is a difference in type among the native Hawaiians, some a bit lighter, with more even features, some more negroid, which strongly backs up the belief that skilled navigators once sailed the Pacific. The diversity of type at once nullifies the theory that the original progenitors of the Hawaiians were a small group, driven off their course by adverse winds to find final refuge on the distant islands. If this theory were correct, an absolute homogeneity of type would prevail. Dixon finds the proto-Negro represented, along with the paleo-alpine anthropological types, in the Hawaiians. And if we ever learn to read the anthropological language reliably, we may discover that the paleo-alpine in this case is the blended hangover of the original Caspian white, using Dixon's terminology, charged by mixture with the pure Negro. In passing, before leaving China, I would like to suggest that the mysterious difference of types in the polyglot populations of Oceania are simply the result of mixtures between the old whites of China or other Asiatic seafaring nations who sent their racial stock down into the enticing tropical islands and then, entering upon their own mongrel-inspired retrograde at home, forgot their colonies and left them to be gradually absorbed into the overwhelming Negro population of Australasia. Thus, it is believable that the more attractive Easterly Islands and New Zealand received more of the white strain, just where today we find a lessened spore of the proto-Negro and more inheritance of white characteristics. In Japan, we find a remarkable variance in racial types. It is easy for the Occidental stranger reading of the faraway peoples to conceive of them as all possessing a certain set and regular type. Such a conception is much in error when held in reference to the Japanese. I long since ceased to be surprised on seeing brown and even grey eyes and Western faces among the higher classes of Japanese. I have heard or read expressions of mystification by others who noticed such and could find no explanation for it. I have known Japanese to have skin colour almost as white as the whitest European, with ruddy cheeks and with such clearly Western cut of features as to baffle detection should they wish to pass as one of the darker types of the Occident. But this is only prevalent among that old part of the Nipponese descended from the old ruling classes, not yet levelled to a homogeneous national type. Japanese artists of past times represented the old conquering race of warriors who built Japan as a fine-featured type with aquiline noses. A semblance of such a type is still often found among the Japanese nobility, the descendants of the old warriors. There are millions of the common labourer and agricultural classes who present unmistakable Negroid features with distinctly darker skins than the higher classes. The platyrrhine, or at least mezzerine, nose and frequently thick, shapeless lips are common among the lower classes and less observable as we go upward in the social scale. This shows that however the origin of mongrelization between the white and Negroid element began in Japan, whether between already mongrelized peoples from the mainland or between actual Negro slaves imported from the south in early times, the leveling of the mixture is as yet much short of complete and lacks completeness in just those layers of the social strata where we might naturally expect to find it. The upper ruling class, descendants of the old Tungusic Yamato whites from the western mainland, have naturally refrained longer from receiving the blood of the Negroid lower classes, just as the whiter peoples all over the earth instinctively recoil at such mixture. As a result, we still have in Japan a ruling class whose members, on an average, are nearly white when compared to the full range of so-called races from pure white to the Negro. But during the long centuries of intercourse with the mongrel peoples of the mainland and with infrequent infiltrations from members of the lower classes who raised themselves in social station, even the very top has received enough Negroid intermixture to dilute the blood to the point where Japan, for centuries, has stood still in her progress. The Japan which Admiral Perry introduced to the progressive white world was as stagnant as a quiet pool without intake or outlet. The initiative of her people was atrophied and could never of its own inherent power have found ways for further forward steps should the Western white civilization never have knocked at her doors and almost forced its way upon her. But once her eyes were opened, her leaders were still capable of recognizing the advantages we had to offer her and found plentiful ability with which to copy. Even here and there, a genius shows forth who steps out and makes independent progress in scientific pursuits stimulated by Western education and example. The very crowded environment of the Japanese, a condition that has prevailed for centuries, has inculcated into the whole people an energy of great force, and this characteristic had ripened them for quick response to anything that offered relief. But without the sustaining vigour of Occidental civilization, Japan, highest of all the distinctly coloured sections of the world, would not go onward to higher standards. She, as well as the lower strata of humanity, should consider well before she aids in submerging the white world with the blood of the yellow, brown and black sections. The Ainus, the strange aboriginal people of Japan, are sometimes classed as members of the white race. They are certainly not pure whites, but on an average are more nearly white than the surrounding Japanese masses, by whom they have been held in subjection from the beginning of the occupation of the islands by the ancestors of the present rulers. At some very ancient time in their history, they received a small quantity of the black man's blood, for they are universally dark, with black, often curly hair, and with a frequent trace of the heavy, coarse features of the Negroid strain. One good purpose they serve in our discussion, and that is as another link in the chain of evidence proving the fallacy of the climatic theory. If environment and climate makes the pigment of a race, as well as other physical features, why are the Ainus, immemorial residents of the islands, and the Japanese, resident there for thousands of years, not more alike in type, even though actual intermarriage has not generally taken place? Southeastern Asia seems to have never had any great civilization, except about the coasts of present-day Siam, a few other spots nearby, and on the neighbouring island of Java. As might be expected, this tropical section, having been the home of a Negro people in the most ancient times, and later becoming a region of refuge for others driven from or escaping slavery in old white China, no great development occurred except where colonists of white Aryans from India settled. In the coastal regions of modern Siam, travellers are held in awe at the ruins of what once must have been a highly developed civilization, so long fallen into decay that little historical record of its life reaches us. We learn pretty clearly that it was the work of colonists from India, whom we know as Khmers. Heretofore, historians have been mystified concerning the cause of the complete decay of the once flourishing culture. This need no longer be a mystery. These progressive builders came some 3,000 years ago from India, when there was still a white Aryan race ruling in that land of brilliance, although it was there being submerged into a mongrel mass. For a relatively brief time, the Khmers ruled and built their cities and temples about between the Irrawaddy and Mekong rivers. It is impossible to say when it attained distinction or when its decay became apparent. That their civilization and their written language began to disappear from among their yellowing descendants from 1,500 to 2,000 years ago is certain. Their effeminate offspring of today are the Cambodians, the Mons or Tailings of Pegu, Kamaks and Khars and other small tribes, the region being in a very hotbed of heavy Negroid population. It was only natural that the master class, as has been the immemorial custom where whites and Negroes found themselves side by side, should use the blacks in menial tasks, either as chattel slaves in ancient times or as miserably paid labourers in recent times. And also, as has been the invariable result, the former mixed their blood with the latter until there was no longer either pure white or Negro. In this particular case, however, the Negro element must have been so predominant in numbers that we still find some of them, undiluted in their black skins and kinky hair, living a miserable savage existence in the forests of the Malay Peninsula. By the time the Thai peoples, immigrating before the inroads of the Chinese upon their more northern country, came into the southern peninsulas in large enough numbers to take the leadership, the Khmers had become so mongrelized that little effective resistance was displayed against the different groups of Thais when the latter attempted to set up kingdoms of their own. The Thais must have already been a mongrelized race themselves, or they would not have been driven from the north by the Chinese. But they must have had a considerable proportion of white blood. The statue of King Khyentsita, first king of Burma, dating from the 11th century, shows a regularity of features with more indication of the white than is displayed by the modern inhabitants of his country. The mammoth temples and other evidences of great architectural and engineering skill in Java prove that during bygone ages a race of builders flourished on that Edenic island. The deterioration of the people had attained such a stage before Europeans reached Java that little of the ancient culture survived. Unquestionably, the brown Javanese of modern times are not representative of the race. Perhaps Aryans from India, superadded on preceding whites from Persia, Babylonia, or even Egypt, which built the temples.
You're listening to Radio Aryans.